Hi, and welcome to Jolly's Spring 2018 podcast series. This is Heidi Hadley, the principal editor of the Journal of Language and Literacy Education, a peer-reviewed open access journal housed in the Department of Language and Literacy Education at the University of Georgia. Today, I will be speaking with Trevor Bogard and Anna Mary L. Consalvo and Joe Worthy about their article, Teaching for Deep Learning in a Second Grade Literacy Classroom. Trevor Bogard is an associate professor in the Department of Teacher Education at the University of Dayton. Anna Mary L. Consalvo is an assistant professor of literacy at the University of Texas at Tyler. Joe Worthy is a professor of literacy at the University of Texas at Austin. Thank you, Trevor, Anna, and Joe, for joining me today. I look forward to hearing more about your work. Trevor, can you first just explain the way that you were conceptualizing deep learning in this article?
Sure. Well, there are three ways that we were thinking about deep learning in our study. One is just sort of building off its definition, which is transferring what one knows in one situation and applying it to a new situation. And, you know, we often think about deep learning as like when someone knows something deeply, they know when, where, how, and why to apply their knowledge. So in this study, we were really interested in how do teachers or how might a teacher teach for deep learning. And so that brought us into thinking about a competencies perspective, thinking about the competencies that are associated with deep learning. And we drew on literature that spoke about the cognitive competencies of deep learning, which are like developing schema and mental models, but then also more of the intrapersonal competencies. And these are skills that would entail knowledge of self as a learner and that deal with metacognition and self-regulation. And then finally, we looked at literature on interpersonal competencies that are associated with deep learning. And this involves teamwork and collaboration, more of the social dimensions of learning deeply during problem solving. And then I guess the last way we're thinking about deep learning dealt with disciplinary literacies. We began to think about deep learning in a domain as involving use of disciplinary literacy, sort of the ways of talking, the ways of acting and composing in a discipline as evidence of having learned deeply. So those are like the three ways we think about deep learning in our study.
Anna, why are multiliteracy such an important part of deep learning?
Well, we looked at particularly a multiliteracies pedagogy, which was very useful for us in terms of how we thought about the episodes that we looked at. Because this point of view really draws on the life worlds and contexts of the people, and including the children, and on multiple modes or forms in which students make meaning, it proved really rich. So we were interested in ways in which students were using all of their experiences and many modes for authentic literacy engagement. What was particularly interesting to us was this idea of design, because design, it actually reflects agency on the part of the learner or the designer or the child. So in the multiliteracies pedagogy by the New London Group, of course, you've got available designs, sort of what is and what you can sort of riff off of, designing or the designed, which can be either be a process, kind of it refers to a process of rethinking that and the redesigned. So within this framework, there was an opportunity for children to make something of their own and for us as researchers to kind of think about this in a theoretical way. The multiliteracies themselves, linguistic, visual, aural, gestural, spatial, and any form of multimodal patterns of meaning making were evident to us in the classroom. So together, these worked really well for us. Finally, this pedagogy, the multiliteracies, the actual pedagogical part of it referred to sort of the teacher stances in a way that made us understand how a teacher could lift up student agency in particular ways through situated practice, drawing on students' meaning-making in their own life worlds, or overt instruction, where students develop conscious awareness over what they're learning and control. And perhaps most importantly, critical framing, which includes social, cultural, political, and historical questioning, leading to transform practice, ideally where students create or redesign meaning and infuse their own purposes and goals into what they produce and as they produce it in their practices.
Thank you. Joe, could you tell us a little bit about the study that you did in this manuscript? What questions were you hoping to explore, and how did your study help you answer those questions?
Well, first, a little bit of background. The study was part of a year-long ethnographic study of an exemplary literacy teacher. And for selecting this teacher for study, I'll just give you a little bit of background about the instructional practices that are typically used, or at least at the time were typically used in this school district. I spend a lot of time in Austin schools, and I've seen that many of the schools in Austin, the elementary schools, use a guided reading approach with groups formed by reading achievement. And that was, in fact, a requirement at the time of this study. And honestly, I'm not a fan. I'm not a big fan of ability grouping. And I wanted to study a teacher who used non-ability grouping in this case, writing workshops, which is the approach that I teach in my classes because it's contextualized, it's relevant. Students read and write what they choose, and it's not ability groups. So May was recommended to me by colleagues as an exemplary teacher, exemplary literacy teacher, who used writing workshop. And I had taken my teacher prep classes to observe her teaching quite a few times. And while I was there, I was so taken with her work with children. Her class was such a hive of purposeful activity and collaboration, and they were choosing what they read and wrote about, but they went beyond that. They were engaging in self-selected inquiry projects and collaboration with their peers. And it just really reminded me of a very productive work environment, and with kids just being super purposeful about what they were doing. And I wanted to just stay there and soak it in. And I did that for about a school year and collected really a mountain of data. One of the major questions for the beginning of the study was how students are socially identified in this classroom through social practices and also academic practices. And so we used as a lens there Wortham's concept of social identification, as well as culturally responsive instruction. And then as Anna and Trevor and I watched the videos and read through the notes many, 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 many times and worked together and thought together about it, this idea of deep learning and how much this class and the teacher's instruction and the children's work reflected that concept.
Anna, what findings were most surprising or interesting to you from the study?
It's so hard to choose, really, because there were many, but choose I will. I would say overall, I was really struck at how there was sophisticated teaching and learning happening with very young children. And in this particular excerpt or data snippet actually shows that where her classroom shows self-monitoring thinking during independent reading. And so May did a lot to normalize confusion in reading. So by that I mean when children were reading, she made it okay, or she taught them that it was okay to not understand everything they read and what to do about that. So rather than, you know, shaming or labeling or anything like that, she lifted that up and, you know, taught that it was smart and really agentive, that word again, the agency, to note that and to be able to sit with that. So she actually taught directly how students can do that. So students were reading their own self-selected texts about mythology. And so she taught about using icons. So that students understood what icons were, she had them brainstorm and recall what ones they were already familiar with. And, for example, like the K for KidFlix, or the big W for Microsoft Word, or the E for Internet Explorer. Those were the children's words themselves. And so they understood that these icons were visual cues for thinking. And then she moved that into actually creating another icon, actually two. So one was a picture of a book for reading and a picture of a thought bubble for thinking. And she would hold up the book icon as she read, and then she'd hold up the thought bubble icon as she thought out loud. And so when she was confused, she would speak into that. And then the children practiced that. And she, you know, it's not like every single time that they were reading or for every single book, but it was certainly something for a complex text that students really ought to be able to do, is this self-monitoring. So they practiced using the icons to help them self-monitor, you know, in other words, to help them reason during reading. And in this way, I was just really impressed that they developed in second grade this metacognitive awareness and language for addressing when something, when they were stuck or when they needed to go back and reread or when they needed to turn to May or another child and ask a question.
Finally, Trevor, what implications does your research have for teachers and for researchers moving forward?
Well, I think there are several implications, but one that I keep being drawn back to is this idea that so much of how we were understanding the competencies, the deep learning competencies in May's classroom, were through the micro level interactions that she had with students. So in other words, it wasn't a set curriculum or literacy program that was inspiring deep learning. It was the spaces that she created in her classroom that leveraged the challenges and sort of the desire that the students had in their interactions around text. And so I would say one implication for teachers would be simply to create spaces where there's opportunity to help develop students' competencies for deep learning. I think that this study shows that these types of dispositions for the competencies are forged through meaningful work. So I think we could recommend project-based learning classrooms where there are opportunities for socializing students into those competencies associated with deep learning. And then I think for researchers, it's important for us to think about what kinds of assessment can really capture more of the social and emotional and intrapersonal dimensions of learning, because I think that this study shows that those are important to helping kids to really apply their knowledge and skills to new situations. So it's not just the cognitive domain. And I think if researchers could really think about ways that assessment could include more of the social skills and interpersonal skills, then we might come a little bit further in and understanding what it means to truly assess and teach for deep learning. We end the paper with a question, is how will we know for sure when students have learned deeply? I think that we've really captured what one teacher has done and what one teacher does to teach for deep learning, but in terms of have students really learned deeply, I think that that's open for more research.
Yeah, that's really interesting. How do we capture that moment of deep learning? Thank you so much, Trevor, Anna, for speaking with me today. I found your work in highlighting how teachers can create a space for deep learning to be so interesting, and I think Jolly readers will too. Listeners, to read this article, check out Jolly's spring issue to be published in April.